either claiming it didn't happen or you're glad it did. And they're saying both things at the same time, fundamentally incoherent. Everyone can agree that is wrong.
The flag was hoisted before the world.
What does it mean, fight back? We have a long fight ahead of us.
Here I am.
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 With Chai Davidai.
When I started speaking up, I had no idea what I was doing. And about 2-3 weeks after that first video that everyone saw went viral, I was invited to a fundraiser in the Upper East Side at some bar. And I show up. I had no idea what I'm doing. I had no idea who the other people are. And I was at a part of a panel. There was a journalist whose husband was a reserve officer. There was a social media influencer. And then there was a clown. So here I am with that clown, that comedian.
Halitzan. Right? Did I say that correctly?
How do you pronounce your last name?
Kozak.
Kozak.
Yeah.
Like the Cossacks. Like
right.
The,
so well.
So here I am with Ami Kozak.
Wow. That was a flattering intro.
A Jewish comedian turned activist, turned social influencer.
Yeah, turned whatever we all had to turn post-October 7th to speak the truth. Yeah.
Ami, I always try to start with the same question.
Yeah.
What kind of a Jew are you?
What kind of a Jew? There's like a serious way to answer this and a silly way, and I want my reputation to precede me. But the short answer is I am a modern Orthodox Jew born and raised in America with a strong a religious upbringing and a Zionist upbringing, Dati Tzioni, you would say in Israel. So modern Orthodox
would you be
Zionist.
Religious Zionist.
Religious Zionist, modern Orthodox Zionist Jew. And you know, as far as Israel goes, my connection to it, I have family there. I have cousins there. I learned in yeshiva in Israel for a year on a kibbutz. I didn't really learn. I slept and hung out and watched Anchorman. But it was very meaningful. To have been there for a year in between high school and college, so I sort of had that classic East Coast American Orthodox, modern Orthodox upbringing. And my Israel education and advocacy, kind of the typical things that you're exposed to in that system, which we can get into. And I put that issue kind of to rest, like I kind of made up my mind about those things and didn't think I'd have to talk about that anymore. And as we've seen post-October 7th in this world, all those things have just come bubbling to the surface.
And so, here we are.
Here we are.
So let's delve a little bit more. Your response, your immediate was modern Orthodox Jew. Mm-hmm. What is modern Orthodox for you? Because as I understand, Jews don't agree on anything, and modern Orthodox Jews don't agree on what modern Orthodox Jews.
Yeah, you could say lowercase m, capital O. You know, capital M, lowercase o, depending on which little community of the East Coast you live in, levels of observance kind of vary. But in general, Shomer Shabbat, kosher, but I go to movies, play regular music, secular music, exposed to pop culture, nothing shameful or demonizing about that, wear clothes like this.
For those of us who are
orange
listening.
Shoes, and, you know, oh, for just listening only, modern clothing, the modern part, which means this belief in engaging with the broader secular world while not compromising on religious observance. And that can translate into different ways. You know, some people I know turn the lights on Shabbos with their elbow, you know, I don't. But in general, there's institutional things that remain strong, adherence to Jewish law, broadly, but also engaging proudly with the secular world and secular knowledge.
Right.
Dual curriculum, that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, when I first met you, and this is how complex everything is, and everything is so nuanced. When I first met you, you know, seeing you face to face, I don't even, you have black hair, you have a black yarmulke. and I didn't even see it. And you're like, you don't even think the guy's Orthodox.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you turned around, it was like, wait, this guy is an Orthodox, and he's a modern Orthodox comedian.
Secular Israelis have told me that my whole life, whenever I, because I think in Israel, the way people look at Dati and secular, it's a little, maybe it's more, maybe you could shed light on this, but there's this binary or prejudging idea of what a religious Jew is,
right,
and what a modern or secular Jew is in the context of Israeli society. But I went on this summer program once, like a Gadna thing run by, I think it was run by IDF. It was like to give you education about the army. It was called Chetz V'Keshet. Uh-huh. You know what that is?
Bow and arrow.
Yeah, and it was just, it was educational as part of like, you do like wilderness and army stuff. But it was cool because my first experience really being exposed to different kinds of Jews, especially in Israel, the Chilonim would look at me and say, you know, I don't like religious people, but I like you. You funny guy, I like you. I don't really like the religious people usually, but you funny guy, I'm mamash, matzchik, you funny. And that was kind of a cool way to, I think, make a good impression on people who otherwise put us in a box as being either closed or not relatable. So,
and yeah. You know, and that's absolutely true. And like mm-hmm. growing up in Israel, you have very set notions of different kind of Jews and who we stand for, because mm-hmm. in Israel, it's also built into the political system.
Sure.
But I do think that, or I feel after October 7th happened, those lines blurred.
Mm-hmm.
And
in Israel, you're saying?
In Israel, everywhere.
Well, here also, we have to work hard in the sort of diaspora to establish Jewish identity. It's not built into the cake. So communities struggle with that, with making sure, especially in the Orthodox communities, there's a commitment to Jewish education and schools and synagogues to maintain a strong Jewish identity in the face of a lot of stuff that can wither away at that. In Israel, it's given. Everyone is, you know, to be Jewish, it's easier in a sense to not, you can kind of take it for granted. Religious or not religious, doesn't have to go hand in hand because there's a national identity that goes with it.
But the thing that was even beautiful here, when on the first or second week after the October 7th massacre, I went to Anshei Chesed, which is a conservative synagogue in Manhattan.
Yeah.
Now, I never go to synagogue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not what I do. It's not part of my life. But I went, and they did this beautiful thing where they had rabbis from all different congregations across Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
So there was an Orthodox rabbi, a conservative rabbi, a Reform, a Sephardi, Ashkenazi, all those. And everyone got along.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, you know, and everyone's crying and everyone's bawling, you know, and we're all still traumatized. And I went home and I told my wife, you know, if we can make this reality, if this can be routine, we're going to beat this.
Right.
You know, so.
I heard Rabbi Wolpe explain what it means to be a Jew. What are Jews? Because everyone's always trying to ask that question. What are the Jews? Is it a race? Is it an ethnicity? Is it a religion? And this is a conversation that's getting a lot of attention in a lot of negative ways today. And in some ways, you have to be called to answer that question and define it. But he had a good explanation where he said that being Jewish is being part of a family. You're part of one big Jewish family. So even if you stray from it, you're still part of this family. No matter what your level of practice or observance is or denomination or ethnicity or race, you are part of this family. And I think what you're talking about is...
You don't have to like family.
We experienced... exactly. We experienced the family tragedy. And in an individual family, when there's an unspeakable tragedy, even if there's sibling rivalry or even if there's been rifts amongst the family, people come together in that state of sort of collective shiva that the Jewish community globally felt... There was this moment of total solidarity and no distinction to be made between anybody and no beef, no qualms. Those all seem very trivial in a world where the anti-Semites and the monsters of the world united us all to feel very, very Jewish.
Right. And in a way, that's also why I wanted to call this a Jewish civil rights podcast.
Yeah.
Right. It's not a Jewish secular civil right. It's not religious civil right. It's just it's civil rights for Jews just because they are Jews, because Jews deserve civil rights like everyone else.
Yeah.
So you were a musician or are a musician, have a band, Distant Cousins.
Mm-hmm.
You are a comedian.
Mm-hmm.
And then now you are this something else.
Right.
What is this something else?
A thinking, attempting to be moral, decent human being. you know, I think that for some reason... Israel seems to break the world's brain, the subject matter of figuring out who the good guys and bad guys are is generally easy for most decent people to understand when looking at most things. But on the subject of Israel or Zionism, and when Israel gets attacked, suddenly this, you know, ridiculous standard is applied to Israel and this inability to see things as they are. And there was no more...
Is it an inability or unwillingness?
It depends, I guess, who the actors are. But, you know, sometimes I think for some people, when you're looking at evil, pure evil, like the actions of October 7th, people react differently. So some people, they see it and they want to say, no, that can't exist. That can't be real. We must, that must be something external. And that aligns with some people temperamentally and politically, where when people commit acts of pure barbarism and evil, there must be something else going on that's not their fault. They want to take agency away from that person. There must be an external system happening. There must be a government policy causing this, an occupation that's led to this. And they refuse to condemn judgment, probably because it's so pure and so unapologetic and proud that maybe it's just emotionally and psychologically too much for some people to process. And that's me being gracious to those people. And then I think there's the hateful side of people where this is what they want. You know, they see this kind of thing and they see it as just. But on that side of the aisle, for people to really commit and allow for true evil to take place, I think, and to perpetuate it, it's not just the monsters who commit those acts, the Hamas terrorists doing it, it's those that celebrate it, that either cover for it in the media, or that believe what they're doing is virtuous and good. And that's when the most evil we've seen take place throughout history. Mm-hmm. Everyone's the good guy and the hero in their own narrative. So that's another big, big thing to try to tackle. But as far as where I play into it, I'm like, hey, guys, the Israel-Palestine issue, conflict, I can forgive a lot of confusion on that pre-October 7th. But if you can't look at the events of October 7th and see a Thai man being beheaded by a shovel, and people screaming with elation doing it, babies being kidnapped from their beds, a woman's battered naked body being spit on and paraded through the streets to mobs of cheering crowds. If you can't see that and say, huh, I don't really know much about this, but I know that's evil, and I know that's bad, and I know that whoever's trying to fight against that, not in absolute terms, not in perfect terms, is maybe something I should look into sympathizing with. If you can't see those things, then your moral compass is broken and it might not be my job to fix it. So what I felt I needed to do was to allow for the voices who would sympathize with Israel and see this for what it is, but didn't necessarily know how to articulate it because they become so co-opted by the confusing language and ideas around this issue. Even calling it a conflict presumes two equal sides here that are both culpable in some way. You know, well, you do bad and you do bad, and it's easy to just be neutral. It feels good. It feels good to say there's a problem with everybody here because it frees you from having to judge, which is uncomfortable. So I just felt like if I could speak with as much moral clarity in this as possible, and you said it very well on a panel we were on, that this is not about politics. This is about cruelty versus humanity. If I can speak from a term of what is morally clear and humane here versus cruelty that we're seeing, it can allow for people to feel good about their support for Israel and to feel clear and just in support and unapologetic without having to capitulate to the confusing language that they've been kind of sucked into.
And you've been speaking, so you've started shifting your social media, or not shifting, adding to your social media more things, just you being serious and raw about what's happening in Israel, what's happening here in the United States and in Canada. I've seen you talk on podcasts. Mm. Why you? Like, you know, a lot of us were reacting in this way. A lot of us feel like, look, there's all this moral confusion. Mm-hmm. If we're being gracious to them saying it's confusion, mm-hmm. I have the moral clarity. You're just... Not just, but you're a comedian.
Right.
At what point were you like, okay, you know what? I'm speaking up.
Well, you know, there's this sort of like argument from authority that only certain people have to be able to speak on certain things. I always did look at my social media itself as a vehicle for entertainment. And part of doing comedy is sort of highlighting a truth. It serves for a different effect. You're not trying to necessarily make people think, but you're trying to make them laugh. And in order to do that, there's a skill in being able to identify something kind of true that you can exaggerate and you can feature. So I think there is connective tissue there to doing commentary about things and doing things comedically, or certainly satirically. But again, there wasn't really a political agenda here, but this wasn't about politics, as I said. I wasn't trying to like say, now I'm going to start talking about political issues. This was just about let's get back to baseline here and all be on the same page, because in a world where we can't know the difference between self-defense and murder, if we don't know the difference between these basic fundamental tenets of civilization, then comedy's days are numbered. These kind of things, the arts, entertainment, being able to laugh with each other, they exist in a world, they have to only, can only exist and be sustained in a world where we have a basic understanding of each other's humanity and decency. And when that starts to collapse, you know, those kind of things kind of need to be corrected. It's sort of like, if you're ill, if you're sick, it's hard to do anything else. So if I feel like the world is becoming really sickened by this, you have to first get everybody healthy and understanding of things before trying to entertain them. And they're not mutually exclusive. Eventually I shifted to try to use some satire to try to highlight what was going on, and I brought more comedy back into it. But as far as who am I think also I made a few things just from a pure place of just my own personal story of being a grandchild of four Holocaust survivors. You know, I was always like under this impression of, yeah, it can never happen again. How did it even happen then? How could that have happened? It wasn't in like a third world. It was in the first world. You're left with this confusion, but you're also comforted that it can never happen here again or in the West again. Like, we're past that. It was weird that it happened, and it always mystified me. But post October 7th, this is how it happens. This is how you can dehumanize entire populations of people, give a few code words, you know. And I'm a big Jordan Peterson fan, and he used to talk about how, like, you know, the entire Nazi propaganda was rooted in compassion. You know, the idea that what they were trying to do was cleanse society, was trying to make society better by killing all of the Jews. And you're seeing the exact same language and MO here. So in seeing that, I just felt like
virtuous hate.
Yeah. So in seeing that, I was just like, okay, this is not a political thing I'm turning my Instagram into. I have to speak to this. And some people called me out for saying, like, how come you haven't spoken about all these other issues around the world? Why are you selecting this? And the answer is because as human beings, we all have subjective values too of things that matter to us personally. And I'm not trying to say that this issue is more important than other tragedies around the world, but to me personally, it was. So I'm not trying to say those other things don't matter, but they're trying to tell me it shouldn't matter to me. They're trying to dismiss my own personal connection to something for the sake of other global issues, which is pretty offensive. I think anybody should be able to talk about whatever they want. And back to the point, this issue was close to me, coming from Holocaust survivors, knowing what I know about Israel in the background and the story, and being able to articulate it in a way that people responded to, like being able to say what people are thinking and can't say, or having trouble saying. I think comedy accomplishes that, and I think this kind of commentary can accomplish that too. So in doing these videos, I started to see that it was helping, and I was happy to lend my voice to that if it could be helpful to people who have been telling me, this is what I'm feeling, I just couldn't get it out in this way, and it's cathartic to hear it.
Yeah, you know, you point to the people commenting saying, oh, why have you talked about other stuff? Mm-hmm. Why this? You know, and Rabbi Dana Fursko talks about how only when it comes to anti-Semitism, only when we highlight anti-Semitism, people start saying, what about, you know, anti-Semitism and racism, anti-Semitism and Islamophobia, anti-Semitism and climate change. And
it has to be bundled with other things, because on its own, it's not enough to condemn.
Exactly. And I think, and the problem is that, you know, a lot of times people talk about anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. Both are really, really important problems. Mm-hmm. By bundling them together, you're doing a disservice to both groups.
Yeah, I mean, would you ever, to me, it's akin to going to somebody's house who's just experienced a personal tragedy and saying, listen, I'm sorry about your parents. I'm sorry what happened. I'm sorry about the car accident. But you know, a lot of people die in car accidents all over the world.
And I've never heard you complain about that.
So I'm just saying, why haven't you spoken out about somebody else you're not connected to or don't share a common history with or connection to or peoplehood with? Why have you not spoken out for them? Why are you only mourning when it's your parents? Nobody would say that. Everybody understands that as human beings, there's objective things that are wrong, like tragedies across the world, atrocities across the world, all should be condemned equally from an objective standpoint. And as subjective individuals that have families and personal connections and shared culture and history, it's a different thing. And everybody gets that. But for some reason with Israel, everyone gets offended.
And the irony is that when it comes to points that the other side wants to make, it's not some eyes on, it's all eyes on, meaning nothing else matters other than whatever you are told to look at right now.
Well, that's interesting too, yeah.
So, and I've heard you in a panel make this point, which really kind of I found very compelling, which is that now you understand better your grandparents' experience, not the experience during the Holocaust, but the years leading up to the Holocaust.
Yeah.
What have you understood better? Like, because I know that a lot of times the comparisons are fraught. I've been making a lot of comparisons to the 1930s. Not everybody likes them. Mm-hmm. I always caveat this with saying, look, it's different. I'm not saying that, dot, dot, dot. But at the same time, we can learn from what has happened. But you're saying the opposite. We can learn from what is happening to what has happened.
Right. Well, yes, I think the problem is, and I don't want to get political or calling out any, well, maybe you have to, because I think we have coming from a culture now that has cried wolf and overused terms like racism and anti-Semitism where it does not exist, to shut down ideas they don't like and to jump to conclusions about what people are thinking and feeling. And I think that's led to this proverbial, like, I don't even know if I'm using that word right, but like the eye roll of the world just by hearing anti-Semitism, so that when it really does exist and when the alarms are being, and our antennas are really going off, people are like, oh, what, anti-Semitism again? You mean just like, you know, it's like when you call Whoopi Goldberg and Richard Spencer the same term, it loses its meaning and it loses its weight, you know? And I had a conversation with Rabbi David Wolpe about it. It's like, save the term anti-Semitism for those who really deserve the term, you know? And there's a difference between someone who doesn't understand a subject. There was an example of it is Whoopi Goldberg on The View said, like, the Holocaust was not about race. It's about man's inhumanity to man. I don't know if you remember that. But, like, she was sort of punished for it. And then in talking about it, she says, I'll never bring it up again. That's not what we want out of something like that. Our advocacy groups can pat themselves on the back all day for we showed her. I don't think we did. We shut down the conversation. We made people less able to talk about these things. So in one sense, that's one element of it that I think we're paying the price for a little bit now, that when we are screaming from the rooftops, some people we'd want sympathy for are just like, what now? What this again? It does have that effect that has happened. And that's more of like, I'd say, for lack of a better description, sort of the left of center politics in our country have been on that bandwagon of maybe overusing the term where it's not always so broadly applied.
But let me push back on that, because yeah. I actually think that, take Mel Gibson, for example, you know, a known anti-Semite from the mid-90s.
Right.
If the world heeded our call back then and sanctioned anti-Semites back then rather than giving them millions of dollars to make anti-Semitic movies, you know, and push for anti-Semitism, then maybe we wouldn't have been in this situation. For me, it's almost like we didn't cry wolf. There was always a wolf, but it came and it just like nibbed us in the ankles. Maybe it bit a little bite. And now when the wolf is like in the chicken coop and like eating every chicken alive, you know, then people are not taking
it
seriously.
But I think people were calling it out then. I mean, it was a whole public scandal and a media frenzy about the movie. Everybody was vocal about what was going on.
And it made millions and millions.
Yeah, it didn't dissuade people from seeing it necessarily, but I don't think people like just pretended it wasn't there. I think there's an important distinction to be made between sort of the far-right anti-Semitism and the far-left anti-Semitism that we're seeing now post-October 7th, which is, you ask me, how do I think this can happen? And I think that, at least for me, The worst ideas of the far right, first of all, they're in a way they're more honest. They're going out there saying, we hate Jews. Yes. We hate Jews. So I can appreciate that. Like, it's very easy for everyone to be able to call that out, because that you can't really say in public anymore, and for good reason. And because of that, the worst ideas of the far right, and I'll say until very recently, are not ascendant in our culture. You don't have shows about the KKK and anchors on CNN spouting these ideas. You don't have like the worst ideas of the far right in corporate media, in corporations, on Disney Plus. You don't see that stuff. But some of the worst ideas of the far left in terms of identity politics, viewing groups through oppressor and oppressed, all of the stuff that I think putting Israel through that lens now is leading to a lot of this moral confusion and condemnation and anti-Semitism. That stuff's been ascendant for a long time and provides a real foundation for what we're seeing today, which is, are there any Zionists on this subway? Show yourselves. This is your last chance. It's just one word change, and effectively it allows for this outpouring of anti-Semitism and double standardizing towards Israel. And I think most of the mobs across the world in the West, in France, in the UK, that are on the left, that are coming from the left of center, they're coming from academia, all that's being animated by these worst ideas of the left, that as long as we can put Israel and the Jews in the proper hierarchical class of oppressor, we can do whatever we want to them. It's a virtuous thing to destroy Israel. Resistance by any means necessary. We're fighting for the oppressed. You know, so as long as you can do that and not view humans as individuals and not have a consistent view of human rights and basic humanity, you can justify atrocity. So there's not really such a difference except for a couple of evasions and buzzwords that are used to hide it.
But then what do you make of now that, you know, people like David Duke joining arms with, you know, so the far right's joining, you know, arms of the far left in their anti-Semitism.
Right, so exactly. So I was saying until very, very recently, you know, the Trump Tiki Torch people were those people. And it was like everyone on the left had no problem condemning their anti-Semitism, right? Because it's right-wing, quote.
Or the lasers from the sky.
Jewish space lasers. Yeah, I've seen her too. She's crazy. But, but it's again, it wasn't as ascendant to me. But now, in a post sort of internet culture, as you're seeing, I was going to say that there's the other element too, which is sort of the radical Islamic elements in Europe and in the Arab world that have animated. I mean, I've heard this term, how anti-Semitism morphs through time and changes and evolves. And it's not that anti-Semitism itself as a definition changes. It's always the hatred, hostility, or wish to do harm towards Jews. The reasons for it are all over the map. It could be theological, economic, social, and depending on what's going on in a particular culture at a particular time, it takes that form. But now, for some strange reason, I'm left to this weird conclusion that at the end of the day, what unites all the forces, the bad forces of the world, is a hatred of the Jews. And somehow, even the people on the right are willing to abandon all of their principles, what they claim to have principles, when it comes to the Jews. And I think part of that is, if I have to explain it, Jordan Peterson said years ago that if you keep on this woke stuff of putting people into oppressed and oppressor class and group identity as paramount, you're going to get a backlash of white identitarianism later on. They're like, we can play this game too, you know? And unfortunately, when there's a backlash of white identitarianism, the Jews don't fall in any of those categories other than the scapegoat that they can all rally around, which, you know, so in other words, when it comes to, I think, this far-right backlash against, say, cancel culture and against even what I would agree are bad ideas, it's more like the Jews are trying to cancel us for because we're calling out anti-Semitism. Oh, that's part of cancel culture. So we can conveniently be put in any scapegoat category depending on which movement is against us. And I don't have the answer as to why that keeps happening. And I think, you know, Thomas Sowell, who's a really great economist that I've read a lot of his work, was asked this question. What can Jews do to release, what can Jews do to reduce the amount of hostility against them? And he said, fail.
Yeah, well, but if we fail, then we are the parasites on the society that...
Right, that's the Douglas Murray thing. They hate them when they have a state, and they hate them when they don't have a state. They hate them when they're rich, and they hate them when they're poor. Who will protect the Jews? Yeah. Only the Jews will protect the Jews. Not Europe, not the Arab world, the Jews.
And
that is what it means to be a
people,
Zionist.
For people listening in,
yeah.
I should say that Douglas Murray is not here.
You don't know that, Shai. No, he just did the monk debate. Did you see that? It's going around today. It's absolutely... He was public about it, what it means to be a Zionist. Anyway, sorry.
But,
I'm a big fan. But anyway, yeah, it's fail. And it's being tongue-in-cheek. It's like, as long as we keep sticking around...
Yeah, it's as long as we exist...
Yeah.
But then, so it's up to us to fight.
And that animates the whole conflict to me in the Middle East, too. It's not that Palestine doesn't exist as a free state. It's that Israel does.
And yes, but then if it's up to us to fight, you're fighting in your way, I'm fighting in my way, why aren't more people fighting?
Well, I was going to ask, how's work, you know? How's it going? why aren't more people fighting? I think,
why aren't more people like
speaking? And why is it so controversial to stand up against anti-Semitism? That's a big burning question too. I think because it's centered around Israel, there's a couple of reasons. I think for a lot of Jews in America, a majority of them over time, you know, you have to ask, what does it mean for them? I know what it means for me. You asked at the beginning of the episode what it means to be a Jew is very tied to my strong affiliation, educational upbringing, community, all my friends growing up were Jewish and modern Orthodox. So in a way, like, one could argue that there's challenges to that because it's insular, but you form a very strong identity when you're forming as a child and growing up. And it's not just that I had a bar mitzvah and that was my last sort of uniquely Jewish memory, but I think as we've become a little more assimilated into the culture, and you're not in a particular community that emphasizes knowledge, affiliation, practice, ritual, and I'm not, this isn't a judgment, but I'm sort of an analysis of what can happen, is that when all of a sudden you're pinned for being a Jew, you haven't been given the tools to necessarily defend that identity, and now you're like, maybe I don't want that identity. Like, if this is what it's going to get me, and I haven't had the positive experience or the rich experience of being raised, and it's not even denomination, but at least with as part of a community of what it means to be part of this Jewish family, whether that's ritual and religious practice or just events and culture and whatever, it's not just having a bagel and lox. It's something more than that. If you haven't had that in your life, why is it worth it to you to fight this battle? You know, why is it meaningful? And if you haven't been given any of the education on the history, then unfortunately the default position, maybe this is the fault of Hasbara in general, and there's stuff to be said about it, of what could be improved, but you don't necessarily have the educational background to defend against the hostile narratives. And maybe you've been given conclusions without an understanding as to why. So I think it's a combination of not feeling necessarily what being called into question as to what your identity is when everyone wants to hate you for being Jewish, one has to ask themselves. So I think that could be a part of why more people aren't speaking up, because they had a bar mitzvah and then they moved on to the world and assumed that civil rights had their back, right? And now when it doesn't, they're like, well, what did I do? You know, and am I willing to sort of lean into this identity and endure the hate or not, you know?
But I want to delve deeper into that, because I have never thought of my Jewish identity mm-hmm. as a choice.
Right.
It's not something that I lean into or out of. It's just something that I am. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm a man. I am Jewish. I'm Israeli. I'm a dad. Mm-hmm. You know, it was a choice being a dad, but now it's not a choice. I'm stuck with my kids. I love them. But
it happens.
You know, when you're saying that people, you know, that American Jews are, and of course we're talking broad brushstrokes, mm-hmm. but many American Jews see that, like, should I be Jewish?
Right.
Like,
yeah. So I think it's like, to what extent do you say you're Jewish versus Israeli? I'm just curious how that translates for you.
So I've always been Jewish and I've always been Israeli. Israeli was front and center mm-hmm. For many, many, many years. I think after October 7th and the reaction here in the U.S., my Jewish identity became front and center, mm-hmm. not because I chose to, mm-hmm. but because the world started pointing and saying Jew.
Jew. But if you divorced your Israeli identity from who you were, even all these years growing up, which is what effectively is Jews in the diaspora, Europe and America, who aren't affiliated with a stronger community that has consciously built a community with institutions, I think in Israel, religious or not religious, affiliated or not, the Jewish, Israeli, the peoplehood aspect of it, the nationality, the patriotism, all that's kind of bundled into one singular identity. Because I'm not Israeli, but I am as proudly Jewish as ever, but I don't know if in Israel it's as cleanly, you know, thought of that way, where I think, so it's harder to appreciate that somebody here might just be kind of, I'm Jewish and that means something to me, but when I'm now challenged on it and hated for it and forced to sort of make no apologies for it, rather than looking, you know what I mean? Rather than standing strong on it, it makes you call into question what it means and if there's not a lot of substance there or background or experience to pull from. And I'm making presumptions a little bit, but I wonder if that could be a big problem of why people feel like it's harder for them. And maybe there's this cultural idea of we want to appease. We just want people to like us. Listen, we're going to write a strongly worded email, but that's it. We just want to go to med school and do some things. Please, just leave us alone. So there's a part of a collective culture of just appeasement that
Jews
being strong, that's kind of more of an Israeli or Sephardi thing, but in the general Ashkenazi world, we're like, okay, sorry.
I'm going to get so much hate mail from everyone except Ashkenazi Jews because of you, but I'll just forward it to you.
Let's do it. Hurry, we're getting spicy.
but okay, so let's be gracious. Like, let's say someone is they want to lean into their Jewish identity. They might not have the depth of community. They love their Jewish identity, but they're afraid. They're worried. They don't know, you know, they've been thrust into the situation without an armor, without, you know, some training. What would you advise them to do? How can they speak up? How can they fight back?
Well, for one thing, I think one of the issues that is problematic is that as long as this is tied, one's Jewish identity is tied to an issue that's been dubbed and just and categorized as complex, then when I'm talking about what Israel, its nation's founding, how Zionism, all that stuff that requires a lot of education and knowledge, once your identity is tied to that in some way, and you're forced to kind of be put in that debate by standing up simply for just Jewish civil rights, it becomes kind of challenging, because if you don't know what's going on, then you just believe the sort of caricature, oh, it's complex. So if it's complex, if I don't know much about it, I can't talk about it, and I can't defend it, and I can't defend what I know to be kind of seemingly obviously morally good and true, that Jews deserve a right to self-determination in their ancestral homeland. But if it's been dubbed complex for so long and I don't know that much about it, then it silences me. It would silence somebody as a Jew in their identity. And that's what's happening in the whole anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism campaign. We're just silencing all Jews in a way, especially the ones who feel uncomfortable talking about the subject, because we've said it's complicated. Mm-hmm. You have to know a lot. But you can't just look at a video of Hamas taking children and assume it's wrong because it's complicated. You know, we've called it complicated. You have to know more. Believe, you know, Norman Finkelstein knows more. So, like, there are scholars that have told you why this is okay. It warmed my soul on October 7th. Ugh, give me a break. But he's a scholar, you know, and a lot of times, and I can ask you also about the academy has flipped the script, that you go into these colleges, which is, to me, the last bastion, the last dynamic area where the dynamic of of parents to students, in a way, this paternal, like, we look to the adults in the room, the administrators and the faculty, to sort of tell us what's right and wrong. It's the last place that sort of happens, maybe into grad school. But before you go out into the world and you're forming your moral identity and center, all of a sudden you're told, oh, flip the script. America's the bad guy? Israel's the bad guy? And the short-sleeved guy with the messed up hair who's bitter and resentful about the world because he should be making more money because he's a genius and is telling you Israel is the devil and the worst thing, and it's actually these and the colonizers, and it's actually these terrorists that are the good guys, it's kind of scintillating, and you're kind of like, oh, maybe I've been lied to. But you trust the adults in the room. After a few years out of college and you have a perspective, you realize that was a bitter, gruntled, pseudo-intellectual who was using his power to sort of feel important and preying on these students. Now, I don't forgive a lot of them in a sense because, you know, I don't know, to rip down a poster of a child, but it's kind of unforgivable, but you can see how and why it happens. I've been going on a bit, but how do people fight back? That was the original question.
Like, because I mean, you've pointed to,
and I can
the
see
why people are so scared, because they're confused. They feel like the authority, the moral authority, or the intellectual authority is above them. It's beyond them.
Yeah, sure.
But you know, but there are many Jews and non-Jews who say, like, look, forget what's happening in Israel. Forget what's happening in Gaza. People are defiling.
Correct.
Synagogues here in the U.S. People are shooting Jewish day schools in Montreal and Toronto. Like, we want to fight here for Jewish civil rights. Mm-hmm. I'm not dismissing what's happening in Israel, but I want to fight here. Right.
So, yeah, here's what I think is what, like, along the lines of what you're saying. You don't have to be a Middle Eastern scholar. If, in fact, the haters on Israel right now are claiming, we're not anti-Jewish, we're just anti-Zionist, that has nothing to do with Jews, and yet we're seeing these swells of anti-Semitic incidences and hate crimes, stuff, then you can point out and say, hey, I may not know much about this conflict and what's going on, and I can't comment on that, but if it's just a critique of Israeli policy, why can't you count Jews amongst equals as under who deserve civil rights protections and to feel safe on campus? And why can't we also be held to the same standard of equal protection in our society, culturally and socially? And why don't we have a right to feel safe? Why aren't, even if you're the most pro-Palestinian person, you think Israel should be Palestine, and you have disagreements on the history, and you have that, and you have that whole narrative, how could you show up at the Nova exhibit and protest the slaughter of Jews, either claiming it didn't happen or you're glad it did? And they're saying both things at the same time, fundamentally incoherent. Everyone can agree that is wrong. I don't care what, you know, and I don't care what your political philosophy or your views on Zionism technically or what the area of the land should be or not be, but we can all agree humanity versus cruelty. And the fact that it's Jewish, for some reason, I'm pointing out that glaring double standard, the fact that it's Israelis, should tell any decent person, no matter their knowledge on an issue, that something is very wrong here. And to be able to speak out just to say that Jews deserve the same treatment and the same level of feeling safe and belong in a tolerant society and be protected, that is something everybody can speak out about. And it's pretty obvious that when you hear language like Zionist dirty water, Zionist pigs, let's cleanse the world, what all of that is. So on those grounds alone, calling out the hypocrisy of we claim to be an anti-racist society and you're supporting Hamas, proudly a racist regime, like where do your sympathies lie? Where are your morals? Where is this coming from? Because, you know, if any other group was the victim of this, if white supremacists were trying to, had a charter saying we need to wipe out African Americans around the world and attempted to do it and kidnap them, and anyone stood up for them, I mean, Scott Galloway talked about that. If I came up and defended white supremacists on campus, I'd be out the next day. Yes. And you have on your campus right now people who praise the events of October 7th as a glorious day of resistance. So just pointing on that alone, not knowing anything about the conflict or the occupation, the history, the struggle, the whatever, the narratives, you don't have to know any of that to know that that is wrong.
I was told by someone at a protest that they are not racist because Jews are not a race.
Mm-hmm.
And the merits or the demerits of that argument aside,
mm-hmm.
what I found most ironic was that this person, they were non-binary.
Mm-hmm.
And I respect that. And okay. I refer to them as they.
Mm-hmm.
Yet when I told them I am not white, I'm Jewish, they refused to accept that.
Mm-hmm. And, identity.
And mm-hmm. it's like we've been told, and I've actually agree with this, and you know, I know not everyone agrees with me, but I agree with that, that you accept people's identity as they define their identity themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And yet to have someone whose identity I respect tell me that I don't accept your identity. Forget respect. Mm-hmm. They don't even accept my identity. Was a really rude awakening.
Yes, of course. I mean, the only it seems like the only state that can exist is a Jewish state. That mm-hmm. cannot, that can't defend itself is a Jewish state. That can't self-determine is the Jewish one. Plenty of other, and I think people in America have trouble understanding this because we are a melting pot here, and there is a very strong separation of church and state, and there's all different, it's a very heterogeneous population. But the idea that so many other countries can exist with common cultures and histories and even ethnic character, no one objects, nobody yeah. cares. Only the Jewish one is causing the problem and animates people like nothing else. And I would say this, I had this idea for like a video I was going to try to do it tastefully because it's a difficult point to make, but it's very resonant. If you just think about it the opposite way, ask all these people who are going crazy on campus, what if the world was such that there was only one Muslim country? There's only one Muslim country that existed, and in 1948 there was a Holocaust of Muslims in Europe, and they had a state, an Islamic state, just one, surrounded by 50-some-odd Jewish states, and those Jewish states were committed to destroying it and kidnapped innocent Muslim children.
They probably couldn't agree when they want to do it. Some want to do it on Shabbat.
And all of that. Well, I mean, just ask them that question. Mm-hmm. Like, and an Islamic professor at Columbia wanted to come in, and they said, no, because you support such and such state that exists. Because you support it. We can't let you on. You support it. You support a Muslim's right to self-determine in I'm flipping the script, in an ancestral homeland.
Yeah.
Just flip the, like, who's the underdog here? And who's the racial supremacist? And who's the one who's supporting racists? So much for anti-racism when you're perfectly fine to support the most racist regimes that would kill you yourself. There's a real masochism here going on for these students. I think they hate themselves.
One thing that
I think if you hate yourselves, it's hard to blame the problems of life on yourself. It's easier to blame others. And I think a lot of it comes from that.
It could be, but one thing that I really noticed from everything that you say is you are in a way almost like the perfect example how Zionism and Jewishness cannot be separated. Right. You keep going back to Israel. You keep going back to the idea of a Jewish state. You keep going back to your identity, even though, like you said, like you've spent a year and change in Israel, mm. but you weren't born and raised in Israel. You're not Israeli.
Mm-hmm.
What do you tell people when they tell you, like, no, I'm you know, I am not anti-Zionist. I'm not anti-Semitic. I'm anti-Zionist. In fact, some of my best friends are Jewish. Mm-hmm. We have a Jew with a watermelon yarmulke here.
Religiously and spiritually, you can't separate Eretz Tzion, the land of Zion, from Judaism. Everyone's like, it's Judaism's fine. It's Israel. You can't separate the connection spiritually to the land. There's two different conversations. There's the modern state of Israel as a historical event, so to speak, and there's a false narrative that that's portrayed as. But beyond that, I mean, the historical connection of the Jewish people to Israel is undeniable. Watch the encampments when they decided to have a bat mitzvah at the encampments and do a Torah reading of this week's portion of the Torah. And every time Israel came out, literally they're doing it to themselves. They're like censoring themselves because, ooh, we don't want to mention in front of Rashida Tlaib that Israel's mentioned all over the place here because that would be awkward. That would be kind of weird. And she's like, you know, standing there next to them and they're doing a bar mitzvah and they're so happy. Doing a Seder, a Passover Seder in the middle of an encampment all about our connection to our ancestral homeland. And I get why other people who aren't Jewish might not connect to that story because it's not part of their story. It's not part of their religion.
It's our story.
But it's obviously part of ours, and no one can deny that. Now, what was your initial question about in terms of...
So what's your response? Someone says,
I'm just anti-Zionist. I would say, okay, are you anti all nation states? If you're anti all nation states existing in this current world that we're in, if you're like everybody is just exists in a vacuum or can exist autonomously on what, like it just doesn't apply. If you're the most gracious understanding of an anti-Zionist is essentially anti all nation states that have every ethnic character. I object to all of them, and I speak out against all of them. And we should all just live in a fully voluntaristic society without representative governments. If you're like a pure anarcho-capitalist that believes that we all just exist on these miniature private properties and privatize everything, and there's compelling arguments philosophically in those ways that...
I don't think you'll find a lot of anarcho-capitalists in the Marxist-Leninist...
So absolutely not, but if you want to be part of what's anti-Semitic about anti-Zionism is its lack of consistency as applied to all other states around the world that no one seems to have a problem with. Japan, no one seems to have a problem with every other kind of country that exists that has any kind of central history, common character, ethnicity. Nobody has a problem with that. And no one seems to be historically aware of the repeated... problem, tragedy of anti-Semitism, and this necessity for Jews to have a sense of protection and safety, and knowing that, as Douglas Murray said, who will protect the Jews in the historically? No one, but the Jews, and that's what Zionism ultimately means. So there's a case that it's hard to understand. I don't have the answer for why. Ultimately, Jews are one of the most persecuted groups throughout time, throughout millennia, for every single reason under the book, and it changes and morphs with time. And therefore, the necessity for one is like Sam Harris, in one of his first commentary on Israel, was saying, I'm going to upset some people here with this first line. I don't believe there should be a Jewish state. However, if there was a case for any kind of state that should exist around some sort of national, ethnic, religious identity, a Jewish one would make the most sense given what Jews have been through throughout history and their unique struggle with being actually oppressed and brutalized and murdered for just being Jews and for every other reason, whether they're poor, stateless, rich, and have a state, hated. So there's a case for that on moral grounds alone. Mm-hmm. And if you're an anti-Zionist in those conditions still and refuse to condemn everything else that would apply to that standard of why you're an anti-Zionist, unless you're fully consistent on that front, I mean, you don't have much... morality to stand on.
Yeah, I mean,
and I think it can be inadvertent for people. They don't realize it in a way. Like it's possible for them to know. I have Jewish friends. I have to do this, but like in a way, I don't feel comfortable telling people they feel something that they in their heart don't claim to feel. I feel like that's disingenuous for people. Well, you're anti-Semitic. You just don't know it. It reminds me of sort of the. I do a lot of Prince Harry parodies where he's like, you know, unconscious bias. There's so much unconscious bias. I mean, how can you fight unconscious bias? You don't know it exists. In a sense that. That's kind of a ridiculous standard to hold on people. So I'm careful of that. But I'm also like, it doesn't take much to make this conscious for
but,
you.
But you know? Again, like pushing back a little bit, if you go back a few years, 2020, the point of unconscious bias affects all of us. We should all be aware of our unconscious bias. Forget the lack of logical consistency there. We cannot be aware of something that's unconscious. But but floating that to the surface, talking to people about be aware of your implicit racism, understanding that you yourself have that, even though you want to believe yourself as a good person.
Right. The problem with that was, fair point, but at the time in 2020, if I'm pushing back a little, which this is getting fun, this is going to get interesting, that was only applied to white people. That only white people possess the unconscious bias, and they're the ones who need to work on it based on their immutable characteristic of whiteness. It's by virtue of your white skin that you're racist, not by virtue of just being a human being interfacing with a world of different people. Obviously, everyone has prejudices and things that are unconscious to them to try to learn about and understand and, you know, combat prejudices you may have. But that standard was really aimed very, very calculatedly and explicitly at white people, which made it pretty racist. No one was saying we all have unconscious bias. No one was making the claim that African Americans have unconscious bias to white people and vice versa or to other groups. I mean, immigrant groups have unconscious bias to each other, but it wasn't a conversation being had and equally applied, given if we're talking about similar standards with regard to Israel or with regard to these issues. So I think that was the main pushback. Most of the arguments, especially on campus, about these topics and in the culture was, it's white people exclusively that have this because they're white. I don't care where you're from. I don't care who you know, what relationships you have. Your melanin in your skin is determining your biases, which is I think, a bad idea, a repugnant idea. Not the idea that we have these biases.
My issue is mostly of... there's so much explicit bias. Mm-hmm. You know, why focus on the implicit bias, right?
Exactly.
And there's so like, I don't know what's in people's heart in these illegal encampments. I don't know what's in people's hearts and minds when they're shouting globalized intifada. I do know what intifada means. Mm-hmm. I do know what globalized means, and that is dangerous. Mm-hmm. And I don't care what you mean or what you think you mean or what you think that you think you mean. You're calling for violence against Jews mm-hmm. around the world.
You're enabling it to happen, and you might wake up one day and be like, how did it happen? How did all the Jews get rounded up and all this stuff happen to these people and these populations? Like, I'm not in favor of that, but you've convinced yourself with this drug of like believing in revolution. Like, what does revolution really mean? And so everything does initially stem from ideas, and you have to be conscious of that in a way. Ideas and ideology translate into action eventually. Because I think one of the impossible standards of fighting racism is we have to stamp out what's in everybody's heart. Mm-hmm. And you might not get there, but at least you can prevent actions. Actions are ultimately what matter. And tolerance.
Like a true Jew.
Tolerance ultimately means, like, I might not even respect you or like you, and I can judge someone for not liking someone for the wrong reasons, but at least we're not going to act violently against each other. And I could just... you know, eventually with time and experience, like, we can get to a place where we can respect each other as individuals and judge people as individuals, and any ugliness we'd feel remains internal, if not gone completely. But to tell people, well, I know you're acting great, and I know your behavior's great, I know you're treating people with respect, but inside, you still feel that way. Mm-hmm. So I consider chanting and the globalizing Intifada a behavior, in a sense, not just something you're feeling. You're expressing something. And so you're totally right. I'm on the same page as calling that out and being clear as what that is and what these ideologies and ideas will lead to in terms of actions. And it will lead to people linking arms, stepping up, calling this guy wearing a kippah. Well, he's a Zionist, so let's beat him up because we're doing God's work here. It's great. Let's rip the poster down because it's atrocity propaganda. That's how I can sleep at night. If I believe that kid was really kidnapped, if I convinced myself that if he was kidnapped, but I didn't convince myself that this was fake, like, they would have a harder time doing it. So yes, you have to combat the expressed behaviors of these worst ideas. Yeah.
So you have videos that are just you cracking up or cracking me up when I watch them. You have videos when you are extremely serious and almost at the verge of tears. Mm-hmm. At least it looks like. How do you decide? How do you navigate that balance between, you know, let me just say, you're not the first Jewish comedian, mm-hmm. but you're doing something that not many comedians are doing.
Yeah, I think there's an imposter syndrome that takes place with every new thing you try, which exists until it doesn't exist. So we label ourselves different things, you know, for a long time. I'm a musician. I mean, I'm funny to my friends, but, like, I don't do comedy. I'm not, like, a comedian. Until eventually, exposure therapy, you do enough of the thing you think you're not supposed to do, and then you're really doing it. Mm-hmm. So a at this point, it's more like whatever I feel I need and feel compelled to make. Last week was really heavy on serious stuff because of the hostage rescue and all of the perversion that immediately took place around that. And I felt like, okay, I can make a funny video and say...
You know, the one thing I was thinking right now, I don't know when this episode is going to come out. Mm-hmm. I really hope there's like way more hostage rescues by the time it comes out. And people are like, which rescue? When was this recorded?
Right. Yeah. But the fact that the immediate response was that, and I wanted to like distill what the clearest message I could say is, was in the most perverted way, the most disgusting spin on it in Western media that I saw on things like Breaking Points and stuff was it really worth all of these innocent Palestinian lives to save just 4 Israeli hostages? When the real question is, hey, Hamas, was it really worth all these Palestinian lives to keep 4 Israeli hostages? Mm-hmm. You're always starting the story in the middle, whether it's talking about Israel generally and the occupation and what all this is happening and terrorism. You start the story conveniently in the middle. These people were taken. And all these people who claim to be compassionate say, of course we should have a ceasefire deal so we can get the hostages back. No. Of course we should have the hostages back, unconditionally. Don't tell me a ceasefire deal as if you're on the side of the hostages. What a sleight of hand that's being pulled. I think Netanyahu should agree to a ceasefire deal to get the hostages back. That is a sleight of hand. They were taken. Give them back. Then we'll talk. Like, don't tell me that it's on Netanyahu to come up with some sort of deal to stop trying to pursue people who were taken. It's on the people who took them to give them back. So when I saw that story unfolding and the way it was being spun, was it really worth it? Not to, excluding the fact that we can have to ask ourselves what is a civilian and who is complicit in these scenarios. If Israel could have walked in peacefully and taken them home, they would have. And not a single person had to die. Terrorist or civilian had to die in the pursuit of these hostages. The reason it happened is because in trying to get them, the car breaks down and they're trying to...
Well, it doesn't break down. They shot the car.
Whatever it is, you're going into a zone where they're wanting to kill these soldiers. What are they supposed to do? Yeah, the real question is, are all these people who have died, some justly, and obviously children who were killed, it's obviously there's tragedy there too. Is it worth Hamas keeping these hostages? That's the question. Should they have taken them? That's the question, because if they could have gotten them. So when this was all unfolding, yeah, I could get on my Instagram and be like, hey, I'm Donald Trump, blah, 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 blah. Or I'm like, no, what? I'm feeling compelled to speak about this in a way that tries to distill what the truest... not just my take on it, but what's really wrong with how this is being presented. And to me, it was exactly that. It's not, is this worth rescuing them? And also the fact that they were saying they were released, which is such an obvious misdirection and lie. But is it worth keeping them? Was this worth taking them? Which is how this whole thing since October 7th should be framed and should be continued to be reminded of people. Because it's so easy to fall into those traps. So that week, I was every day posting videos that were serious. Yeah. This week, less so. You know, it's a gut thing of the mood of being plugged into this can put you in certain spaces, you know. Yeah. And sometimes it's like a balance of like actually satire. Like, you know, I did a video of Naftali Bennett. I played Naftali Bennett being interviewed on the BBC. And he's like, I cannot believe what I'm hearing. Christian, this is crazy. And she's going like, you know, they're showing, basically interviewing him. He's like, now, how do you know that these rockets were fired and these were actually weapons caches? And, you know, this tunnel that you destroyed, isn't it just an escape room for a bachelor party? You know, that kind of thing. So, like, you can satirize what's ridiculous about the conflict. And he's just like, you know, like, Naftali Bennett always seems a little constipated to me. He's always just like, I cannot believe what I'm hearing, you know? But anyway, depending on the mood of the week is what I decide to post, you know?
And that brings me to another question, which is, you have been so... outspoken about not just the topic, not mm-hmm. just the things that are happening in Israel, things that are happening here in the United States, but also specific individuals mm-hmm. and specific individuals on the, I hate using the word the other sides, mm-hmm. but you know, the anti-Semites. Mm-hmm. What have your interactions been like? You know, and you don't have to say specific people. You can mention specific people, but...
I mean, look, one of the spooky things is if... I think, you know, as I was saying before earlier about the reaction to the woke left and cancel culture, the opposite extreme is now the inability to discern what ideas are fair game to discuss and appropriate to discuss and should be debated and what ideas are just meant to provoke and hurt and play with. And I think now the latest, coolest, edgiest thing on the sort of far right circles of anti-cancel culture in its nasty form is anti-Semitism. Let me say what I want about Jews on Twitter. Let me use the word Jew provocatively and play with it. And let me ask questions about the Holocaust and how legit it was, and show a picture of an anti-Semitic cartoon and be like, why can't I post this? Let me really test the limits here, because I'm a free speech absolutist and I could just say those things without examining, is every idea, just because you can say it legally, worth being in the marketplace of ideas? And I think that's the lack of critical thinking that's the reactionary element to the woke left, which lacks, I think, critical thinking to debate ideas too. But now on the farthest right that lacks critical thinking, they're like, well, if I can't, what else can I say? So anything I can't say is worth saying and worth provoking. And I've had, so on the worst elements of it, you see these guys who I won't name because I don't want to popularize them, but they're all over Twitter, just freely tweeting the most vile anti-Semitic, unapologetically anti-Semitic stuff you can think of. Posters of which members of Congress and business and putting a little Jewish star. We've been co-opted. We've been captured. Israel and the Jews are controlling us. And not just Israel, the Jews, typical Jew behavior. There's these people out there with followings in the far right elements, the Fuentes world, the Nick Fuentes world, that are proudly anti-Semitic, can't defend it, can't hide behind it. And then there's people sort of adjacent to them because they're like, well, hey, I want to be able to say these things. Why can't I say these things? And there's sort of this catch-22 where it's like, if I call out, if somebody says something anti-Semitic, we say, hey, that's really anti-Semitic. Oh, you're trying to control me. See, the Jews control everything. So what are we supposed to do when we see anti-Semitism? If we call it out, we're controlling. If we don't call it out, we allow it to fester and grow. And so there's a catch-22 there. How can you tell me I can't call it out and say that's me proving your point and you proving my point? And
well,
that's really
wrong. I have a different spin on this. I think it's really interesting what you said, because my spin is the people that were the enforcing cancel culture, the people that were enforcing the canceling of individuals, they are the ones using Zionists as Jew.
Yeah.
So the people on the far right feel like, oh, there's no cops now. We can say whatever we want. The people on the far left, we're like, oh, good, you know, we're not going to cancel them for calling out Jews. So you have those on the right finally feeling free to say what they want when it's only specifically about the Jews, and those on the left saying, we're going to cancel everyone, including Jews, just not the people calling out Jews.
Right, yeah, I'm trying to figure that out. It sort of reveals when, like, the left of center Jew who feels totally alone and abandoned by those who he championed along the causes with, that the far right was never on board with, but is now trying to find themselves in a space of, at what point do these ideas go too far? These elements can go too far. This idea of being hyper-tolerant on one side till you tolerate intolerance, till we can't, to confuse and call violence speech and speech violence.
Yes.
It's insane. On the left, everything that was speech was violence, and now actual violence is just speech. As long as we're talking about the Jews, we are as free speech advocates and absolutists as we can be all over campus. It depends on the context. Well, now it does.
And the example everyone gives is Skokie.
Yeah. Yeah,
yes,
yeah.
That's free speech. Well, guess what? It was also against.
Now you see these figures in the commentariat, in the conservative commentariat, that are playing with these ideas, and it's tempting. You know, I've had a conversation with Candace Owens that was pretty public about this issue, and it stemmed from her retweeting the Queen of Jordan initially saying, "I think Jews are weaponizing anti-Semitism to silence people into compliance," and I think for her, she retweets that saying, "I agree," and I called her out, and because we had a prior thing where she had liked some of my comedy stuff, to her credit, she had me on the show and we spoke about it for an hour. And it was a civil conversation about things. And at that point, and this is months and months and months ago, I was convinced, and I still am, that that ignorance is easier to combat than hate. And in other words, when you respond to people who are certainly wrong and are saying things that are totally, even abhorrent, like in some cases, it's hard to examine where they're coming from and to engage with it to a certain point is worthwhile to some respects. Since then, her relationship with the Jewish community, I don't know if I moved the needle or did anything, but I also did see, I saw things that can push people who are already in a bad place and are bad trajectory further away, meaning if you come in bad faith with these people and if you misrepresent things you do not, like I saw pieces of my conversation with her being misrepresented and clipped out of context. There's no need to do that. Then it looks like you're trying to be dishonest. And the best thing you do is have integrity and be honest. And she has certainly said things that have really, really troubled me since that conversation and that I would object to and call out. And I think what it is it goes back to, like, people on the far, further to the right do not like being called something as a label that they internally claim not to feel. Nobody likes to do that. The anti-Zionists don't like that either when you call them that. But there's a difference between words, feelings versus words and deeds. If you're acting in a certain way and you're peddling and emboldening anti-Semitic tropes and engaging in rhetoric that's creating suspicion of Jews, advertently or inadvertently, and at some point it becomes advertent because there's a pattern here, then whatever you claim to feel inside, like you said, it might be irrelevant. But I'm not going to claim that's what you're feeling inside because I'm not there. But you can analyze a certain pattern of things and has to be challenged. And, you know, it's been really upsetting to see, but I still hold, I'm still optimistic that as long as the channel is open for debate and conversation, that it's worth pursuing. I don't know if I can maintain that optimism, how long, but we shall see.
You do it well. You do it well. I don't think I have the same calm and serenity to have that conversation with people that you do.
Mm-hmm.
So I try to end every episode with a Jewish lighting round.
Mm.
I'm going to ask you to just, you know, answer as quickly as possible. There's no wrong answers. And you get one pass.
Mm-hmm.
You can ask for a pass. I might not grant you one, but you can ask. All right, Ami. Mm. What is one thing people don't know about you? What is it that you answer really quickly to questions?
I'm Catholic.
What is one thing people don't know about the Jews?
We're only 15 million people.
What is your favorite curse?
Shvach. I don't know if that's a curse.
Is that a curse?
Something Yiddish.
Shvach. It sounds like...
It was so shvach. It's not a curse.
It sounds like the sounds I make when I bend over.
Yeah,
now.
Much. That's so shvach. Shvach, nebuch. They're not curses, but I'm going to go with words.
When was the last time you cried?
Oh, I know what it was. When Jerry Seinfeld was interviewed by Barry Weiss and she asked him about his trip to Israel, and Jerry, who has always maintained sort of a stoicism and a calm as a public persona and as a prominent Jewish figure who's been somewhat outspoken about this and went to Israel, and I've always admired most his commentary on comedy and life, and he just paused and broke for a second. And she asked him, and what was that like for Israel? Being in Israel, what was that like for you? And he just paused and said, and he said that he visited the Nova Music site and with people and paused, and he just looked right at her, sort of Jew to Jew, and said, you know, and was breaking down. He just said, you know, and that just wrecked me.
If you could have any person over for Shabbat dinner from any moment in history, who would that be?
Right now, Douglas Murray. Nice. He's just rocking it. We got to get him.
What's your favorite Jewish holiday?
It's definitely not Shavuos. I am dying right now. The dairy, everyone's like, oh, Shavuos, we're going to eat light. And they're stuffing themselves with lasagna and cheesecake, Jews and lactose. So it's not Shavuos. I love Sukkot. I love Sukkot. I love Sukkot. The weather in Israel on Sukkot is just tops.
The next question was, what's your least favorite Jewish holiday? But I guess we all know now. You have something worse than Shavuot?
Tisha B'Av. Brutal. 25 hours in the heat. And everyone's like, well, just watch movies. But if the you can't watch 14 hours of sad movies. If the last 2 hours of the fast are terrible, my head is killing me. It's brutal. Tisha B'Av makes me nervous.
When do you feel safest?
Definitely not online. With my family and friends and the people who really know me.
When do you feel least safe?
Washington Square Park.
I second that.
There's hostage poster Ripper Downers everywhere and purple hair. And I'm looking around, I'm like, you definitely ain't as, you're definitely okay with that. Just to know that that's in people's hearts is pretty spooky.
What gives you hope?
I think that for all of this, challenges and things that we're facing, telling the truth and speaking for that truth speaks to a silent majority, and I say majority, of good and decent people out there who are watching this whole thing happen, perhaps impartially because they're not connected to it. Jews are 15 million people, 0.02% of the population. We're a small minority, so there's many, many people who have no connection to this, and that's just the reality. No fault of their own or whatever. I don't expect them to. But when they're watching this, their inner decency is seeing the hoodlumism on campus, the destruction, the people in these encampments who are breaking down Grand Central Station and burning American and Israeli flags and holding up terrorist flags and Hezbollah flags and seeing the footage from October 7th, if they do come across it, and saying, I don't know really much about this, but I'm not on that side. And at the end of the day, the decency will connect and resonate with those of us doing our best to tell the truth and not being confused by the moral confusion that's happening on campus, in media, and across the world.
Finally, every episode I urge the listeners to donate to one charity that does good in Israel or across the Jewish diaspora. Where would you want people to donate this week?
Yeah, I mean, the charity one I saw is like a, I mean, you know, it's hard for me to point in a particular direction, but these days I'm starting to see how important it is to become, have civic engagement and contribute to representatives and people who align with your views and values, because we're witnessing members of the squad on campus emboldening all of these worst ideas and apologizing for all of this horror. And they start in very local districts, and you know, it becomes significant when our representatives are there in politics.
So you're saying more money in politics?
More money in politics. Yeah. I would say that to be engaged and involved in that way, as far as charity, I mean, there's so many things you could contribute to. But it's hard for me to pin down one, because it's hard for me to stand on one. But in general, to be engaged, otherwise this stuff can sweep over your head and you find yourselves in a world that is pretty frightening.
Yeah.
So more money in politics. I raised $50 million.
Ami, where can
people, overnight?
Where can people find you?
You can find me on Instagram, TikTok at AJ-Comedy, Ami Kozak Official, and Twitter at Ami Kozak. And my band is called Distant Cousins. We're making music. We're making Jewish music, English music, all put together. And you can find me all over social media. And my podcast is called Ami's House. Me and my co-host, we talk about all these kinds of different ideas. It'll be a good schmooze. We'll have you on.
I'd love that. So throughout history, the jesters have been the most important people in the courtyard. Mm. And I see you as one of the most important people in this fight. You have a skill that many of us don't possess, and you use it for good.
I have the best words. Yeah, thank you.
So
thank you.
Here I am with Ami Kozak. Thank you very much.
Pleasure.